Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. From Wondery. How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing fine, Justin. How are you?
I'm doing good. You were on a show?
Right. A friend of ours who we met at CrimeCon, Maggie Freeling, she has a new show and I was on it. Her show is Unjust and Unsolved. And the reason I was on it is because she knows that one of the cases that I have kept up with is the Ronnie Long case. Well, Maggie Freeling, her background is journalism. She's the perfect person to take on exactly what her show is, Unjust and Unsolved. Those are the kinds of cases that her show tackles. So if that's of interest to you, you want to hear me on episode one, then search for Unjust and Unsolved with Maggie Freeling on whatever podcast app you use. I highly recommend it.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend. Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
So tonight's case, Aaron, is what most people would call a horrific murder. We're going to be talking about minors here and children. So just forewarning, this episode's definitely going to revolve around a child murder. With that, what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight, we'll be talking about the November 3rd, 1998 murder of 8-year-old Maddie Clifton.
This takes place in the Lakewood neighborhood. It's on the south side of Jacksonville, Florida. It's a working class neighborhood. Children often play together. Neighbors know each other. In the 1980s, Steve and Sheila Clifton moved into a home. The couple had met in high school around 1970. Steve worked as a foreman at a local metal shop, and they brought two wonderful children into their home, Jessica, 1987, and Madeline Ray on June 17th, 1990. The family was very tight-knit. They were very close. Madeline goes by Maddie. Everyone just called her Maddie. She was described as a very well-behaved, polite, and happy tomboy. She loved playing piano. She took dance lessons. She liked playing football, hockey, and basketball. In third grade, she attended the San Jose Catholic School. In 1996, Steve and Melissa Phillips moved in across the street from the Cliftons. They both worked as computer scientists and had moved from Pennsylvania and spent time living in Vermont. Steve had two sons, Daniel and Benji, from a previous relationship. But in 1984, the couple had their own son together, Joshua Earl Patrick Phillips. Joshua was very familiar around the Lakewood neighborhoods. He would walk the family's dog, that's a little beagle, and he would often join the other kids and play baseball, sports, what have you. In ninth grade, Josh attended the A. Phillips Randolph Academies of Technology. He averaged around a C in school, but he didn't have any record of disciplinary action or truancy. He really liked to read. He even worked on computers. So a smart kid. That's kind of where our story starts, right, Aaron?
November 3rd, 1998, sometime around 4:30 in the afternoon, Maddie arrived home from school. Well, she worked on the piano for about 30 minutes and then went off to play. It was close to 2 hours later that her mom was calling all of her kids in for dinner. When her 11-year-old Jessie arrived, she was asked where Maddie was. But Jessie said, "She's not with us, Mom. She wasn't with us." And so the mom is a little panicked. "What do you mean she's not with you? Wasn't she outside playing with you?" This is something, as a parent, you send your kids outside, there's sort of an assumption at times that all the kids are playing together. But Jessie has to tell her, "No, I haven't seen Maddie since I came out from my piano practice to play." So Sheila got a hold of some of her neighbors and they started looking around the area for her daughter. It's within about 13 minutes that she called 911 to report Maddie missing.
She didn't wait long at all on that one.
You can't, because every minute that starts ticking past, you're losing valuable time. So it's better to panic at first and get the troops together than to wait too long. And then now you really have no idea where your daughter is. This search really builds up. The police department in Jacksonville, the fire departments, even U.S. Army Reserve and Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FBI, volunteers, thousands of them get involved. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and the Missing Children's Help Center in Florida were showing Maddie's picture and asking the public for assistance. They're getting the support they asked for right away, which is, that's an incredible thing. And we always ask, what kind of a community do we have? Well, seems like the Cliftons had a very good community. The community was right there with them from the start. Even their neighbors you talked about, they were involved in the search. The next day, Sheila called into a local radio station. She's pleading once again for Maddie's safe return, and volunteers are handing out flyers. Not only was there a search, but now they're going through the radio, they're going through TV. Everyone's getting to know Maddie's face. And there's even a $50,000 reward for her safe return. Now, we said there was a huge search. The police had canvassed that entire Lakewood neighborhood, and they even talked with Josh, and he'd been known to play with Maddie on occasion. But he said, "I didn't see her that day." But once they talked to the neighbors, the other neighbors, they found out that that wasn't true. Some of the neighbors actually saw Maddie outside after she went out. One of them said, this is Larry Grisham, he said he was chipping golf balls in his yard. He said she was right there with him for a little bit. And he said, you know, it wasn't unusual because she would kind of just go around to the different neighbors' homes because she was really friendly. That's the kind of community they had. The Cliftons felt comfortable with their kids just going outside. She told him at some point that she was going to go home to get more golf balls so she could continue to play with him. But she didn't come back. This was kind of a weird statement because as far as they could tell, this could have been the last time anyone had seen her. So the police looked into his background and found that he had two prior arrests, one in 79 and one in 82. These charges had been dropped, but they were charges for sexual battery. So you can imagine that the police really start putting this guy under a microscope. Luckily, they don't just stop there, but they're looking at him. They even had him take a polygraph and he failed it. But he did spend 8 hours being interviewed. And when he was asked for his DNA, he gave it willingly. Larry, despite being a good suspect, is basically saying, take whatever you need. I want to prove my innocence. I have nothing to do with this girl's disappearance. The search continues. You can imagine what they do. They drag ponds. They look through brush. They even get the okay to search in some homes. But they start looking again at Josh. They look inside of the storage shed on that property that Josh lives on, and then look in his dad's car, but still nothing. Then there's a news conference. And we've seen this before where the parents are on TV. They are scared for their daughter. They're crying.
Yeah, pleading for their safe return.
Maddie's mother, Sheila, said, "Maddie, if you are out there and you can hear us, we are ready for you to come back home. Maddie is a very strong little girl. She is full of love. Maddie, please come home." And then her dad said, "If someone has Maddie, please let her go. Let her go anywhere and run if you have to. I know with all the people out, she would be found immediately." This reward that was $50,000 then got up to $100,000. So again, there's this huge push. This push grows and grows and grows. We're talking about U.S. Navy pilots. We're talking about football teams, including the Cincinnati Bengals. This is an effort to bring this girl home, but it's not working. All I can tell you is throughout the week, they kept looking back at Josh Phillips and his home because they just feel like there's something not right about it. One of the reasons is there was a neighbor who saw Josh outside of the house near Maddie as if he was creeping up on her. And this neighbor said she watched just to make sure that he wasn't going to shove the little girl down. But then she saw Maddie turn around and then she knew he wasn't going to shove her down. So then she went into her house. But again, it's suspicious because, well, was Larry the last one to see Maddie or was it Josh Phillips? Now, this whole case takes a turn because on Tuesday, November 10th, 1998, this is about 7:30 in the morning. Josh is at school. And his mother says she rarely went into his room, maybe about once a week. But she went in there and she saw that there was fluid on the floor toward the end of the waterbed that Josh slept in. And she thought, oh, that might account for this weird smell that I'm getting in this room. One of the things she noticed, too, was that the bed was taped together at the corner because the bed frame had been broken.
And this is an old waterbed. I used to have one of these back in the day, and the bed frames were just garbage, you know, press wood, and they didn't last very long, especially to teens that put a lot of wear and tear on them.
So she pulls this board out, and she sees two small feet with white socks on them. Now, Melissa freaks out and she runs out of her house. Police are still canvassing the neighborhood. They're still searching. She runs to these police officers that are actually stationed on that street. She said, "I need you to come back to my house with me." And of course, the Phillips house, it's a crime scene. So you can imagine that once the police start taping it off and the Cliftons are looking out, they have a really bad feeling in their stomachs that maybe Maddie was discovered just across the street. They were informed that Maddie had been found and police confirmed right across the street from you.
The detectives go and pick Josh up from school and bring him in for questioning. This spreads like wildfire, and other parents go to the school and start bringing their children home early because they don't know what's going on. And now they know that one of the students is probably a suspect and they're going to protect their own children.
Before Josh really talks to the police, his father, Steve, talks to him and says, "I need you to tell the police what happened." Josh says, "Okay, I'll talk." He gives a story. He says, on that day that Maddie disappeared, he said that Maddie came over to his house and asked if he would play. And he told her, "I can't, I have chores to do," but she wouldn't stop asking. So he said he finally relented. He said, "I'll play, but just for a few minutes." Now, he claims that his dad was very abusive and had warned him not to let other kids come over when the parents weren't home. So while he's playing with Maddie, he says that he accidentally strikes her in the head near her left eye with a baseball. They were playing baseball in his backyard. So Maddie goes down to the ground and starts screaming. Josh apparently says that his first fear, his instant fear, was that if his dad found out that he hurt the neighbor girl, that he would beat him or something. He was scared of his dad. So he said that he dragged Maddie into the house, into his bedroom, and saw that she was bleeding and crying. So he's like, my dad's going to be home soon. So he said that he took his baseball bat and struck her over the head a couple times to get her to stop screaming, you know, to knock her out or something. But she kept making noise. So then he retrieved a knife, a pocket knife, and stabbed Maddie a couple of times in the throat. And this is when he decides to put her under his waterbed. As you said, the sideboard there could be kind of junk on a lot of these. So he pulls it off and he pushes her under there. But Maddie continues to make noise. She's moaning. She's breathing heavily and she's whimpering. So according to Josh, he stabs her multiple times in her chest to get her to stop screaming. And then he pushed her back under the bed and taped the sideboard back in place. So there's a confession. Case closed, right? The police have him. He's a 14-year-old neighbor who says that he accidentally injured Maddie and then in a panic killed her to silence her because he was afraid his father would do something horrible to him. This is quite a story.
But you think about, there's this huge search going on for Maddie, and the whole time he's hiding her corpse under his waterbed. I mean, he knows he's done something wrong. He knows right from wrong.
Well, we would assume, but he actually went to the Cliftons and said that he would like to help search for Maddie. So you can imagine the Cliftons are very, very upset because they know now that Josh hid their daughter, that he had killed her. There's very quickly an attorney brought on to represent Josh Phillips. His name was Richard Nichols. Now, Richard Nichols didn't enter a plea for him, but Josh was formally charged with Maddie Clifton's murder. The judge ordered that Josh be held in isolation in a juvenile facility. Remember, he's only 14, so it's not long where a grand jury indicts Josh as an adult with first-degree murder charges. What does that tell you, Justin, if he's being potentially tried as an adult here?
Well, they think the seriousness of the crime and his forethought to conceal the crime is not on par with a child murderer. They're thinking this guy is something more, you know, essentially a severe danger to society, and we need to take this case more seriously than we do in juvenile court.
They also believe that he premeditated this murder, that this was planned. So all of those things being factored in, yeah, they don't see him as just a 14-year-old. They see him as a major threat to society. There's some things we should talk about here. This was a very shocking scene. Maddie was found under the waterbed, as we had said. Josh had used deodorizers and incense to try and mask the smell of Maddie's body that was decomposing. You can tell that this is all set up to maybe get away with it. If no one notices a smell, if no one looks under his waterbed, maybe he gets away with this.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm thinking is, what was he going to do? He would eventually have to dispose of her body somewhere. How does a 14-year-old figure that out without being caught? Luckily, he was caught because it was a stupid plan to begin with.
And there was plenty of evidence in the room, not just Maddie's body, but they found the baseball bat that he beat her with behind his dresser. They found the knife that he stabbed her with, which was a Leatherman multi-purpose tool. It was obviously bloody. They also found blood-stained tennis shoes that Josh wore, and they found blood on the ceiling fan in his room, which was hanging down from the 8-foot-tall ceiling. Here's one of the disturbing things, if you're not already disturbed, is when they found Maddie, they saw her skirt pulled up and her underwear was underneath her. They also found that her hand was gripping one of the supports, you know, part of the frame underneath the waterbed. So she had lived after being attacked the third time for some time until she died. And they know this because of the way she was gripping that frame.
It's a horrifying thing to consider how much trauma and hurt this child went through.
So the family was getting support. People were coming by and dropping off stuffed animals, flowers, cards, balloons. There were ribbons of hope that were yellow or purple that people were sharing or wearing or putting on their trees. People were talking about Josh. They said, this is a good kid. He was very polite all the time. He had manners. Teachers talked about him, said they just thought he was a silly kid. No one could have predicted that he would have done something like this. Her funeral was held on November 14th, 1998. There were about 1,400 people in attendance. Obviously, there was family, friends there, but so many people got to know Maddie when she went missing that this was a funeral that they needed to attend. It seemed like the entire community was there because they all cared. She was buried in Oaklawn Cemetery in Jacksonville. So we know Josh is headed to trial. His lawyer tries his best to get stuff thrown out. He wants to suppress the confession. He wants a psychological exam. He's looking for anything that can help his client.
And he wants a change of venue because everybody knows about this. Some of the people on the jury could know Josh. So he wants this moved somewhere else.
This is all the news was. How would he get a fair trial when he's already been tried by the media? Everyone knows who he is.
Yeah, and they know the body was found under his waterbed. How do you defend against this?
That's an excellent question because I don't know. But his attorney seemed to be a calculating guy. In fact, Josh's mother would comment that she often felt like he was changing tactics regularly without informing them and also trying to just say, trust me. But she was stressed out. And her husband was doing his best to say, stop, just trust in the attorney. That's why we hired him. Court TV broadcast this trial. I remember back in the day, it was like Court TV would come in and you could actually see trials happen in front of your eyes. It was such a weird time. Nowadays, we just take it for granted that we can see stuff from the trials. But back then, this was pretty damn interesting. All we know about this, though, was they only allowed one camera because both the defense team and the prosecution said one camera's enough.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So it was supposed to start in May of 1999, but it ended up being postponed to July. There were about 200 potential jurors. In the end, they settled on a jury and had 2 alternates, 12 men, 2 women. It actually began on July 7th of 1999. Let's first talk about the defense. I know normally we start with the prosecution, but it seems to me that even today, all these years later, the defense's case is the one that gets all the news. It's the one that spreads throughout all the stories if anyone reads about this case. What were they saying?
Well, they were giving the statements that Josh had confessed to, which was this was an accident and he overreacted to the accident because of pressure from his father. It's that narrative.
Josh had said that his father was an alcoholic. He was also a very big man. What was he, like 6'6"?
Yeah, intimidating.
And apparently even Josh's mother, because she had talked to the media, said that, you know, her husband could be a scary guy, that sometimes he had a temper. She said she and her son had to walk on eggshells. So I think there was some understanding within his family, in the Phillips family, that Josh was afraid of his dad. While many people would say, why would you react that way? Why would you kill the girl, though? Because that seems like it would be way worse than just saying you're sorry.
Yeah.
But again, we're talking about a 14-year-old. How many times do we have to say it? A 14-year-old making a good decision? I mean, that's iffy, right?
Yeah, they don't know anything. But he knew enough to try to conceal this crime. And that's definitely a sticking point.
Right. So despite Nichols doing his best to present this case as an accident gone wrong, the prosecution was there to take that narrative head on and attempt to dismantle it. I know that when I was reading up on this case, my first question was, when they did the autopsy on little Maddie, did they find any evidence that she had been struck with a baseball? They found no indication that Josh was ever playing baseball with Maddie. And not only that, but they never found any evidence that she had been struck with a baseball in or around her eye area. So they said, there's no physical evidence. Also, when Josh said, I had to drag her into my room, they said, well, if she was bleeding and he was dragging her, then how come there's no blood outside of the house, outside of his room, and there's no dirt or gravel or anything from her being dragged in? So they believe that she was picked up and carried in or led into his room.
Exactly. It's maybe this altercation did not start outside. Maybe he brought her inside. That changes everything. It's no longer an accident. It is a premeditated attack.
There were various people who testified at this trial. None were testifying in favor of Josh. They were all testifying against him in a way. There were neighbors talking about what they saw and heard that day. There was the woman that said that she watched Josh sneaking up on Maddie, and she was afraid that he was going to push her down, but She said when she saw that that wasn't what was happening, she turned around and went inside the house. One really interesting thing that came out during the trial, and I really want people to understand this point because I feel like the narrative on this case has been false or not clear enough.
Or it's just been reported on in an extremely biased manner. Like you said, the media always gives the defense. They never really give the prosecution side because I don't know if we want to give benefit of the doubt or what, but in this case, all we've heard is his side of the story.
And again, if you read about this case, you will hear about an accident and then Josh Phillips overreacting and trying to silence this little girl for fear that his dad would discover that he had hurt her. In court, Maddie's mother said, "I had told my daughters, Jesse and Maddie, not to play with Josh because he had started talking to them about sex." Now, remember, when Maddie was found, her clothing was hiked up and her underwear was pulled off. They looked, you know, during the autopsy to see if she had been assaulted sexually, but there was no evidence of that. But still, if you think about it, this is very, very suspicious. So when the medical examiner testifies, the medical examiner says that Maddie had been attacked in three separate incidents. Any one of these would have been fatal. So the first one was Maddie was struck in the head on the top of her head and on her forehead with a baseball bat. The second attack, neck wounds from the knife. These are wounds that punctured right through the windpipe. So Maddie was bleeding profusely. But the third attack were the 9 stab wounds that happened to her chest and abdomen. They say that those were inflicted when Maddie was already dead. But if he had put her back under the bed again, then why was her hand clutching the framework of the waterbed? They actually brought in a reconstruction of that bed to show how Josh had hit her body. So I guess what I'm trying to say is they're putting it together that this was no accident, that Maddie was led into the room and attacked because they didn't find any evidence that she was attacked outside the house ever. So how come she's only bleeding, only having been attacked inside that room? They know because of the blood they found. So they know he's lying and they're able to get that across to the jury. The question would be, because Josh is 14 years old and because Nichols, the attorney, is trying to say, look, this is an accident, don't judge him for the rest of his life based on this one thing. He essentially made a mistake. He panicked. How is the jury going to side on this? Because you and I talk about this. We're like, can you take a 14-year-old and just put them away forever? I mean, is there something to the born evil or what have you? I mean, Sheila was quoted as saying that she didn't know that the devil had moved in next door.
Yeah. And the defense has really no defense. So they do their opening statement, which was Joshua Phillips is not a monster, but because of an act that began as an accident and deteriorated through panic that bordered on madness, he engaged in a monstrous act. The defense at that point rested. They didn't call any witnesses.
It was apparently some sort of strategy, I think, because they felt like it would give Nichols the last word. But did it work? July 8th, 1999, the jury deliberated before noon. They took about 2 hours to deliberate. What did they find?
They found Josh guilty of first-degree murder. 2 hours of deliberation is no time at all. That's enough time to read through the charges and just find somebody guilty of first degree or second degree if the prosecutor offered them different levels. I mean, there was no conversation here. They found him guilty immediately and brought back that verdict.
We talked about Josh being 14. Apparently, the jury couldn't find it possible to give him any kind of mercy here. There wasn't any to give. When you go over the crime and the concealment and the lack of explanation that makes any sense, then what are they left to do? Josh's father is really upset because he's like, to put any 14-year-old away in prison for the rest of their life is ridiculous. It's ludicrous. But of course, the Cliftons would say, our daughter already has a life sentence. She's gone forever.
And that's the problem here. You know, on paper, in theory, I don't think you should put any minor away for life for something they did as a child. But in practice, how does that play out? And with this case, we know that some Supreme Court rulings came down that would have some impacts on children, minors being sentenced to life.
It would at some point, but when Josh was sentenced, the judge addressed him. Judge Charles W. Arnold said, "I do not perceive you to be a child. Your monstrous act made you an adult." So they were either going to give him death or life without parole. He's 14. You're not going to put a 14-year-old to death. So they gave him a life sentence. He was 15 when he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. After this trial, more investigation information came out to the public. One of the things that they were talking about were, just like I said about during the trial, the physical evidence didn't back up that this started as an accident. They talk about the autopsy. There's no dirt on her body, no sand. All the blood evidence was found in Josh's room. And then that idea that while she wasn't sexually assaulted, but her clothing was off, Josh apparently had talked about sex to the Clifton girls. He was also spending time on his computer looking at sexual websites. And this included time just before Maddie was attacked. When they went through his computer, they found thousands of files. He'd been visiting pornographic websites that included cheerleader torture, first and best sex crimes, Nazi sex slaves. He also had images of young girls in nude and provocative positions on his computer. So they know from the timestamps on the computer that he was looking at some of those same websites just before Maddie was killed. This is what upsets me, is that the prosecution in this case did a wonderful job. The investigators did a wonderful job on this case. And we have this narrative that continues whenever you read about this case that there was an accident and Josh panicked. I think it's time for people to read into this case what it actually is. I mean, Josh doesn't want to talk about what happened. Flash forward to now, he wants to talk about how he's a Buddhist now and he's trying to help other people and that he thinks of Maddie all the time. You and I had quite a conversation about, does he need to show remorse? Look, he apologized, but it doesn't mean anything to me because he has never, ever faced this head on. And to me, it would mean a lot more if he actually came out and said, "I had some dark thoughts in those days. I acted on an impulse that I shouldn't have, and I can do nothing but regret it now and feel sorrow for the family, even my family, you know, the Cliftons and the Phillips, for what I've put them through." But he doesn't do that. And I hate to say it, but I think it's because those thoughts are his private thoughts and he doesn't want to let them out.
Well, he doesn't want anyone to know his true self.
Exactly. I agree with that. I think that's the only way I can look at this case. If he really does want to be let out at some point, because he'll get his opportunities, parole chances will come, but won't the Cliftons be there to talk, to support Maddie and say, "Don't ever let this guy get out"? But on the other hand, you have Josh putting on this friendly face and saying, "I want a chance at life again. I want a second chance."
I'm torn on it. I really am, because again, my initial response to any teenager, any minor being sentenced to life is, no, we have a juvenile system in place. Why aren't we using it? Why do we bother with a juvenile system if we're just going to try people as adults? But in this case, was Joshua Phillips a soon-to-be serial killer, a soon-to-be serial rapist? Did we stop a monster? Has he been rehabilitated? Our system of incarceration is not about rehabilitation. It's about punishment. It's about locking people up and getting them off the streets. It's not about getting them to reacclimate into society. And it's not about fixing somebody that might be broken and might be a serial killer or a serial rapist. It's not about that. Does this kid at the time, he was a kid, does he deserve to be in prison for the rest of his life? Well, I would say no. But am I okay with them letting him back out on the street? I'm not sure.
I look at it from the perspective of, what did Josh do? What did he do after he killed Maddie? And then what has he done since? I see nothing. Absolutely nothing. I've seen interviews with him. I've seen nothing that tells me that he's a different person.
And that's the problem right there, Aaron, is there are people on a parole board, people like me and you. And you look at this and you say, I see nothing. And I look at it and say, it's been over 25 years and he says he's a Buddhist monk. What are we doing with him? Is he a threat? Is he not a threat? I don't look at the part of, did he show remorse? I just look at, where is he now? I don't consider that. And I'm sure parole board hearings, they have those same views and attitudes and opinions of, does it matter if somebody comes clean or not? I'm sure some people think it does matter and others don't.
What's the first thing that people have to do when they go into AA?
They have to admit to all their faults. They have to admit that they're an alcoholic.
If there were questions here about whether he was guilty or not, I get that he wouldn't have remorse. I get it. But there's not a question. There is no reason in the world for us to doubt that he's the killer of Maddie Clifton. So again, I think it is important. The reason that he's not facing what he did is because I don't think he wants to let it go. He wants to hold on to this. And I personally would not feel comfortable releasing him. That's a strong statement because I don't like the idea of kids being sentenced to life in prison. Would I prefer that he got help? Sure. But the other problem with that is he was evaluated. What did the psychologist, Tom Bowery, come back with? He said, this is not what I would have seen as the typical kind of sociopathic, wanting to kill, wanting to maim, deriving pleasure from the pain of others kind of kid. I don't think that's true at all. Now, we could say the defense hired this guy to evaluate Josh. So maybe he's just trying to tell them what they want to hear. But I don't think that helps anyone. There's something wrong with Josh. And it would have been nice if he had been evaluated and someone could help him. I think that's something he's never gotten. If anybody has read up on this case, they'll know that Josh has stated when he was confessing to police that he lived in a fantasy world. As long as he ignored things or forgot that he did them, he could move on and everything would be okay. I think he's still doing that.
It's a gamble. If you were to let him out and he doesn't commit any more crimes, then hey, the world is safe. But if you let him out and we have another dead child on our hands, then it's the system's fault. In a situation like this, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. We're over-punishing a child for his crimes as a child. Now he's an adult. But how can we evaluate somebody like this? It's our lack of mental health care in this country. And it's our lack of rehabilitation for our incarcerated. So in a perfect world, this would play out differently. But in the world we live in, a lot of people don't feel safe with this guy coming out. And I get it.
On June 27th, 2000, about 11:15 in the evening, Steve Phillips, this is Josh's dad, was driving on County Road 267. This is just south of Tallahassee. And it's not too far from where Josh was being held in prison. Well, he was driving his vehicle, but went off the right shoulder and then overcorrected. And the vehicle overturned. I said Steve was a big guy, and I guess he didn't like wearing a seatbelt, probably because it wasn't comfortable. He was thrown from the vehicle in this accident and died at the scene. No one really knows what he was doing out there, but it was said that he would just get so upset at the fact that his teenage son was sent off to prison for life. He just could never accept that. So it's possible he was just out there thinking about it. I feel as though his emotions got the better of him.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
These tragedies continue. Moving on to the Clifton family, Jessie, who was Maddie's sister, said that just 3 years after her sister died, her mom moved out of the house. Jessie and her dad continued living there, but her parents divorced. I guess it's because Steve just couldn't talk anymore with his wife about this, and his wife needed to talk about it. You know, we all handle grief in our own ways, but this was really putting them at odds. Sheila, she does her best to try and explain this because she doesn't want people to think that they hated each other or anything. They were destroyed by the actions of their neighbor and the loss of their daughter. Sheila said, "My husband, he was just so stricken with grief. We just went in different directions. Watching her grow up, the dreams and the hopes that we had for her are gone. And that's a hard thing for a mom to accept." Later, Steve would move out and Jessie would go on to buy that home. Her parents had a hard time living there after what happened, but she said that was the home she knew and she loved being there. But she said it was very hard because she felt like her family was destroyed. Now, you said earlier, Justin, that this idea of just sentencing a minor to life in prison, that's not going to fly anymore. We have a Supreme Court judgment that says so. But we also have appeals. And Josh's attorney is saying, this is not appropriate for a 14-year-old. And he even says, under the Eighth Amendment and the Florida Constitution, you can't do this. So I want this changed. You need to give him the possibility of parole. February 6, 2002, the District Court of Appeals of Florida, Second District, they answered. What did they say?
Upheld his sentence, which kind of goes against what that Supreme Court precedent says. So the first try is no, we're keeping him where he's at. But they're going to continue to appeal, right?
It's determined at some point that Josh's culpability may be diminished somewhat because of his age at the time that he committed murder. The factor of his age is outweighed by his heinous conduct and the ultimate harm, death, that he inflicted upon his victim. So his appeals aren't working. Now, his mother, she asked him why he did it, and he wouldn't tell her. He didn't want to talk about it. She asked him how he was doing in prison. That's an interesting question because he was really young when he went in, but he said that he was never assaulted or physically attacked. He continued his education in prison, graduated high school, and worked as a law clerk.
And he didn't have a lot of violations. He was a well-behaved prisoner.
2004, he gets a new attorney, and this attorney filed a motion for a retrial. He said Josh's former attorney, Nichols, who had died just 2 years before, didn't do a great job of representing Josh. And he has many reasons. One of the ones is, well, he didn't call any witnesses. He didn't ever submit a deposition instead of calling the psychologist to testify. So he's like, there are all these problems with the trial. And if I were his attorney, we would have presented a much better case. And maybe he wouldn't have been sent to prison for the rest of his life. The assistant state attorney disagreed with him, Jay Plotkin, said, "Mr. Nichols was a qualified attorney who represented his client, and that strategic decision was up to Mr. Nichols and the family." How many times have we said this? It's a strategy. It didn't work. You can't look at it later and say, ah, I would have done it differently. Well, that's because it didn't work. And now you're saying, here's how I would do it. But sometimes you get just the one chance, don't you?
Yeah. But see, that's where I do agree that it was inadequate because it's a terrible defense. I guess I look at that and I think if I had a flat tire and a mechanic said, you can keep driving on it for a while. And, you know, once it gets down to your rim, then we'll change the tire. I would say that that's inadequate. It's a strategy, but I have problems here that they literally gave an opening statement and then did nothing, didn't call any character witnesses, didn't really cross-examine much. That's terrible. We can say, well, that was their strategy all day long, but maybe the strategy was, I'm going to get you an appeal for not defending you properly. Who knows how that strategy goes?
They have to try, right? You know, the whole time the mother of Joshua is trying her best to get people to listen to her and say, look, he was 14 when this happened. It's essentially a death sentence for him to be locked away the rest of his life. Does his life mean nothing now? And of course, you have the Cliftons. You have Jesse out there who's saying, you know, Maddie doesn't get a chance at life again either. So why are we worried about Josh? And I should add here that despite all of this, the mothers here in this case, they're both very supportive of each other. They may not agree on what should happen, but there's an understanding and sympathy there between the two of them, which I think is really, really nice. But Justin, you brought up the Supreme Court case. And in 2012, when it was ruled 5-4 that automatic life sentences without parole for juveniles was unconstitutional, that started a fight. And by 2015, they said, not only is this going to stay, but it's applied retroactively. So that affects thousands of inmates across the nation. And it affected Josh Phillips. So he was going to be resentenced.
Now, that resentencing doesn't exactly go as Josh's attorneys like. During the resentencing in 2017, they asked Josh to be sentenced to 40 years with credit for time served. So that would mean Josh would be able to get out when he was 55 years old.
Yeah, they say it was consistent with new Florida law for juveniles who are convicted of murder, which mandated 40 years. So instead of life, it would be 40 years. Well, the prosecutor says, how about we get life for Josh here? And then after about 25 years, we can review everything.
And that's what they essentially fall back on, right? Is after 25 years, he would be eligible for parole.
On November 17th of 2017, the judge resentenced Josh to life in prison, but he will get an automatic review at the 25-year mark in 2023. That's not that far from now. That's just a few years away. So the judge explained his reasoning here. He said, this act was so outrageous that if he was out, the community would continue to suffer. Okay, Mr. Phillips, it's a sad day for me. I just tried to do my duty the best I could. So it sounds like the resentencing worked in a way, you know, because otherwise Josh wouldn't have had a chance at parole at all. But now they're saying, we'll do a review at 25-year mark. But I don't know. They really seem to fall back on the prosecution here because it was their recommendation that was followed. And, you know, during this process, Justin, even Josh took the stand. But again, I think he just misses the mark. He doesn't explain anything. He just talks about his hard times. He says, growing up in prison, I've seen many dark things and I've been in some dark places. I had no clue what life meant, what death meant, nor the depths of suffering that would follow one act. I did something horrible and I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Even now, after all these years, it's just so unfathomable that all this could have occurred. It tears my mind to know that I stole such a precious life from you, from the world. I wish I could take away your pain. But again, I feel like he doesn't explain anything. And to me, this could just be the words of someone who's suffering. He's suffering.
I look at this and I think, what can he say at this point to appease the family and the loved ones of Maddie? Personally, I don't think he should say anything because his voice doesn't matter to them.
I think if he explained what he did, if he owned up to what he did, instead of hiding behind this accident story he came up with, I think it would matter. I don't know if they would find any more sympathy for him. I personally feel like the court might have reacted because to me, it would be a big move. It would show true remorse. Because how many times do people say they're sorry, but you almost feel like they're just saying they're sorry for themselves? I can think of a name right now, Joseph DeAngelo. When he says he's sorry, is he really sorry? I think not.
Well, and I think with Josh, I mean, admit to being a sociopathic serial killer in the making is going to make things better. Admit to having horrible dark thoughts that drove you to brutally murder an 8-year-old girl. I don't think this is going to help him get out at all.
Well, as it stands, we'll just have to wait till 2023 to see what happens with his review. But I'm expecting him not to be released. But I'd be interested to hear from our listeners and see what they have to say about this. Do you think 25 years is enough time if he's released? Do you think that's the court's discretion? Or do you feel like he should be in there longer? Again, he's growing up in prison, essentially, because he was only 14 when he was arrested. So he's been in the system for quite some time now. I wanted to cover this case mostly because I feel like this accident gone wrong narrative is kind of annoying, knowing the facts of the case. I feel like this is a different case than that. That was just a story that was brought up to try and rescue a 14-year-old from a certain life sentence in prison. Sheila Clifton, Maddie's mother, made a statement about Melissa Phillips, Josh's mom, and she said, "I feel for her and I love her. It is not her fault. I do not blame her. It is Josh. It is all Josh Phillips' fault." And also, Jesse Clifton helped Melissa out. She would help her with groceries or run errands for her. There was this feeling that she needed support just like they did, and they didn't blame her for what her son did. And I think that shows a level of maturity and a level of compassion that I don't think many people have, or at least enough people. So for them to reach out the way they did to Josh's mom, despite what they said about her son, I think it means a lot, and it shows the character of the Clifton family and of Melissa, because I think Melissa Phillips was in a very tough position. Her son was being sent off to prison. Her husband was losing his mind over this. She was too, but she was somehow able to connect with the Clifton family, and I think there was a bit of a bond formed there. So if there's a silver lining in this case, it's just that compassion can still exist in the darkest of times. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.